Welcome, everyone, to Ed Table Talk. Today's topic, or title of our show, is Passing Judgment, How Your Instructional Assets Are Being Reviewed. You can find Ed Table Talk at edtabletalk.org. I'm Bridget Foster. I'm guest host today, filling in for Michael J., who sadly lost his father on Sunday. So he's very busy this week, and we're jumping in to take over for him and hopefully do him proud. We have a lineup of terrific guests for our topic about instructional assets and review of resources. And if you're wondering why I've been asked to host, I have a little bit of background there in instructional review. I'm the former executive director of the California Learning Resource Network. And way back in 1999, the California Department of Education started a resource review process that we managed and was probably at that time one of the few instructional learning resources review in the world that was state or in any official capacity. We had 57 countries looking at the information we put online, and all of the U.S. states, and the state of Virginia was our biggest user. So information is seen by a variety and used by a variety of users out there, and I think that's always important to note now that we have internet access for all of this. So looking back at kind of the history of reviewing and evaluating resources, we now have a variety of sources to go to online that provide various types of information and data around usage of resources, effectiveness, and alignment to curriculum. But in the early days, there wasn't that much out there, and it all kind of stems back to the adoption process. Michael asked me to maybe tell some humorous stories or kick it off with something interesting. And one of the things I learned, amongst many things at CLEARN, was that the adoption process was really a result of the Civil War. And if you look at the map of the states as they aligned to the Confederacy or the Union at that time of the Civil War, and you compare that to the map of states that are adoption or open territory states, you'll see a lot of similarities. And the issue was that states in the South did not want the publishers in the North, and those were predominantly where publishers existed at that time, dictating the curriculum for their students. So they decided they would outline what the curriculum was, what they needed, provide that for the publishers, and expect that it would meet those requirements. So sometimes why we do things stems back to something totally different than expected. Let's no further ado here. Let's meet our esteemed guests and start the table talk around review of learning resources. So first guest is Christina Marks, and I'm going to let the guest introduce themselves. So Christina, tell us a little bit about you.
Thanks so much, Bridget. My name is Christina Marks, and I work for Achieve. I lead the work of EQIP. That is an acronym that stands for Educators Evaluating Quality Instructional Products. Our mission is to make sure that high-quality instructional material and aligned instructional materials get in the hands of educators, and also build educator capacity to determine high quality and alignment to ensure that good materials are getting in the hands of teachers and helping students, helping to close the achievement gap for students.
Great. Thanks, Christina. Next guest is Carl Rectanis.
Hey there. Thanks for letting me join you. My name is Carl Rectanis. I was a classroom teacher and then an administrator, but I'm currently the co-founder and CEO of a company called LEARN, my third education technology company, and we were founded, frankly, because of the lack of data around quality education technologies. We created a platform called Learn Trials. It's a research-backed, web-based ed tech management platform that equips educators and their organizations to make data-driven decisions about which products are best for their classrooms. And I'm looking forward to the discussion today. Thanks for having me.
Thanks, Carl. And our next guest is Jackie Lane.
Hello, I'm Jackie Lane. I'm the founder and president of Learning List. My career has been sort of circuitous, but I've been in education for over 20 years, first as a school attorney, and then I worked at the local, state, and federal levels, including in the White House, doing education policy. I started Learning List because so many school administrators were telling me that they were tired of spending hundreds of thousands or millions of dollars of instructional materials that failed to live up to publishers' claims. Learning List's mission is to help educators choose and use instructional materials most effectively by providing professional, independent reviews of K-12 instructional materials.
Great, and welcome, Jackie. And before
Thanks.
We get to our table talk, I want to just thank our sponsor, MCH Strategic Data. If you don't know MCH Strategic Data, you should. They can provide you with the information you need to find the customers you want. So you can find them at mchdata.com, and I speak from experience on this one. So we're at the table, and we're ready to talk. And as with anything virtual, we had a little plan ahead so that we could kick this off. So Carl has volunteered to kind of to set up and frame this conversation and get us going. So, Carl?
Thanks, Bridget. Yeah, this is a really important conversation, and I'm sure the listeners sort of understand. But based on our experience at Learn Trials and the data and the information that we integrate across thousands of educators, we can tell you that right now in almost every school, educators are evaluating 3 to 5 different products at any given time. Those could be in pilot phase. It could be, you know, as they're implementing or considering for, you know, whether they're going to renew and keep those products next year. And when you boil it down, those questions aren't which products are best, but really which products are best for me, for my situation. For teachers, it's about what's best for my pedagogical style, my student groups, a particular learning standard, and the alignment that I know our other my colleagues can speak deeply to. At Learn Trials, we've actually identified the 8 most important areas for educators when they try, buy, and use these tools. And they range not only from learning alignment to ease of use and navigation, bugs and glitches, student engagement, and other areas. We actually have a rubric on our site at learntrials.com. But, you know, teachers aren't the only ones involved in that decision-making process, as I'm sure everyone who listens understands. You know, oftentimes principals or your curriculum and instruction leaders have very different questions than what a classroom teacher would have, right? They're thinking about how to improve the capacity of their teachers and educators, how to figure out what's moving the needle for their students. So your chief academic officers and curriculum instruction folks, you know, as you move up the organization on one side, and on the other side, you also have your operational folks, your chief technology and chief information officers, who are going to be asking questions, you know, first and foremost around data integration, data privacy, does it work with the systems we have already, those types of difficult questions. And then finally, you know, certainly within the decision-making path, you've got superintendents, board members, other stakeholder groups. And we all know that being a superintendent's probably one of the hardest jobs in the country right now, worrying about everything from board meetings to bus schedules, student safety to student achievement. So being able to analyze across these different areas, the instructional, the fiscal, the operational aspects of these products to make those decisions are all informing the conversation about what a quality tool is. So I think as we talk today, it's helpful to think about, you know, from a role-based approach, you know, teachers might think about specific products or tools, learning instructional resources in a different way than, say, a chief academic officer or a district CTO might think about those. And it's important for our listeners to know who they're talking to when they're trying to share the quality or understand the quality of their products. Does that make sense?
Yeah. And so, Christina, you approach this from a little different perspective in the whole, you know, scheme of things and actually train people to apply evaluation criteria. Do you want to talk a little bit about what are the importances there and what you feel are really important points to make when you're evaluating resources?
Sure. I think, I think it's super important to have a common set of criteria and evaluation tool. I think that it's very, very important to use a tool that evaluates quality and alignment to the standards, and making sure that all students are supported with those set of materials, and providing enough support so that teachers can implement those materials. Obviously, we think the EQIP rubric does a fantastic job in evaluating lessons and units, and using tools like the IMET tool when you're looking at evaluating a year-long curriculum to make sure there's, you know, the right progression of learning, and also thinking about the balance of informational text to literature. And but in terms of the process, we think that it's critically important to engage educators that are going to be using the materials. So in addition to having school leaders and folks at the district office, curriculum folks, I think it should be a team, sort of a cross-sector team that are trained on a common tools, and they're all examining the materials through a common criteria, and that it's super important that they calibrate the use of that tool to ensure they're all interpreting and applying that criteria in the same way. We do a lot of work building the capacity of these teams to do that with the EQIP rubric. In addition to into that, we have sort of what we call the independent collective. So we think it's important for folks to examine materials independently and then come together and discuss their findings that are supported by evidence that they have found from within the materials.
Great.
I'd just like to, this is Carl, I'd love to say kudos to, you know, the importance of gathering insights from all of those different perspectives, I think is really critical to making strong decisions, both at a qualitative level, tied to rubrics and alignment, but also quantitatively understanding how these things are actually being used, what's actually happening, what it's meaning for student achievement and other things. That's really why we created Learn Trials too, but I just want to echo that sentiment. It's very important to get everybody's voice involved.
You know, and I think it's important. Sorry, Bridget. I was just going to say with that, you know, building in that feedback loop and examining student work is critical to the process, and knowing that sort of all instructional materials are works in progress. But understanding, I think Katie Haycock once said that students can do no better than the task in front of them. And so, you know, having some sort of protocol that allows you to examine students' work and the alignment of the task itself or the summative portion of the materials to ensure that the materials are high quality and aligned, and to be able to go back and forth with developers, knowing, you know, having this data to show that these materials aren't what they said they were, and having that open discussion and creating that feedback loop into the process of purchasing and selecting materials.
I agree with that.
Mm-hmm. Sorry, Bridget, this is Jackie Lane. I agree with that. I hear constantly districts complaining about materials, but if they don't communicate with evidence the deficits that they find in the materials, and publishers can't improve it. And I do believe that developers of content, whether online or print, have as their goal to support teachers' teaching and students' learning, and that this should be a collaborative process, and only through that collaboration can we truly get high-quality materials to students in the way that engages them and in the way that supports teachers teaching them and meeting their needs.
And I think that can be built into the RFP procurement process. So the developers going in know that they're going to be held to this criteria, and unless it meets these criteria in this process, they can't. The districts can't go forward with those materials.
One of the things I always advise districts is have your most, if you're going to purchase online materials, have your most technologically competent and least technologically savvy teachers test the materials. Try do a lesson. Teach a lesson with the materials just to see whether it's easy to use. Because if the materials are not easy to use, then there's no point in going further. Whether or not the materials have the best content, it doesn't matter if they're not going to be used.
Great point, Jackie.
Sorry, Bridget.
Go ahead. I was just going to say I loved it. There not only are there a number of sources for information and review processes and data, but that everything is so transparent, collaborative, and easy to use. That whole talking about everybody being part of the conversation and contributing to the improvement, ultimate improvement, and ongoing improvement of learning resources is critical in what provides for good stuff out there in the market.
You know, the number one reason we heard that teachers weren't using the materials the districts buy was because they found the materials not to be aligned to the state standards. The second was because they didn't feel like they had a voice in the selection process and they weren't convinced that the materials selected were going to meet the needs of their students. So what we do at Learning List is do an independent, detailed verification of the publisher's correlation, looking to make sure that the citations that the publisher includes are truly deeply aligned to each standard that the publisher intends to cover with the product. With regard to helping create a more inclusive selection process, we have tools to help make that easy so that all educators have a voice, or as many educators as the administration wants to allow, has a voice without taking a lot of time in the selection process. So I do advise districts, you know, make sure that you include the people you want to use those products in the selection of your materials. Otherwise, chances are they won't use it.
I couldn't agree with Jackie more. We hear all the time from educators that the materials that are being purchased by districts are not truly aligned to college and career-ready standards, and it's so important that the process for selecting materials includes criteria around the shifts in college and career-ready standards, you know, the balance of informational text, academic vocabulary, text-based evidence, reading text closely, and then for the mathematics, the application, conceptual understanding, procedures with fluency, you know, the general shifts around focus, coherence, and rigor. And so making sure that that there is a set of criteria around the instructional shifts is so important. And if we have any chance of closing the achievement gap, we have got to include the supports for struggling students working and reading below grade level, and English language learners, as we know so much of our population moving forward will be English language learners. I just had a conversation with two teachers last week, and they were sharing with me how the materials they were using, while well aligned, didn't have the supports for those students. A lot of the students were working well below the grade level, and while there were some instructional supports and scaffolding built in, they were not for students 2 to 3 grade levels below, and that's so much of what teachers are facing currently, especially as we're sort of making this shift in instruction around the Common Core.
And I'd actually extend your argument, Christine, to not only is that important with regard to Common Core, but states like Virginia, Texas, and others that haven't adopted Common Core. It's just as important for developers to be aware of the priority standards in those states and adapt the content not only to align specifically to the nouns and the verbs and the context of the state standards, but also to the prioritization of standards in the state.
There's no doubt that alignment is, you know, table stakes from a curricular standpoint, and I think that's, you guys make a strong point for that. We have seen too, Bridget, that just as a frame of reference, you know, within our platform, educators and their schools and districts can integrate a number of layers of data, including verified teacher experience, which we actually see that once learning objectives alignment is, you know, in place or considered, meets a certain level, feature set, bugs and glitches, ease of use starts raising in importance depending on your level of savviness. But the districts also look at a few other, three or four other things pretty strongly. Actual usage, right? So integrating usage data to figure out, you know, we hear what teachers are saying, but let's look at what's happening with actual usage. Being able to integrate pricing information, certainly. And finally, and this is the one that I think we spoke about earlier, is student outcomes. Is are we moving the needle for students? And we've seen by being able to give districts level of visibility to those things, both inside their districts and across districts like them, that they are starting to do things like build, you know, those expectations into RFPs, as Christina mentioned. They are putting that in place and making all of those from teacher voice all the way to actual outcomes be a part of, you know, what constitutes a quality product or product quality resources that move the needle for their particular situation.
Is it becoming a fact that because software as a service and cloud-based computing is becoming so prevalent as opposed to locally installed applications, that more data can be collected around usage and ultimately inform not only instruction but also development of resources? Are you all finding any truth in that?
Yeah, we are. You know, at LearnTrials, we're certainly seeing that for the districts that we work with, that they're leveraging, you know, usage data to help them understand what they're paying for and may or may not be using and what situations that's working for them in. And as a just as a reference, we actually released an infographic last year across half a dozen products, half a dozen, and all were core instructional products in the either English language arts or mathematics areas. Across almost 20,000 students, just looking at usage, we found that a pretty consistent usage paradigm for those products, and that had to do with both implementation and the products themselves and the quality and alignment and professional development. There's a number of different factors. But to boil it down, you know, the dosage or the amount of use of the number of students reaching sort of full dosage of those products in most cases was under 8% of students. And there were over a third and sometimes upwards of two-thirds of paid student licenses were not being used, not being used enough at all, or meeting any milestones set either by the company or the product. In that type of situation, as districts start to understand and recognize that, they're certainly going to shift their investments, from low impact or low use products into higher impact products as well.
And are there methods of determining why they're not being used?
There are for us. I mean, because we've integrated, a combination of qualitative insights from verified educators on their actual experience with those products in those situations, as well as student achievement, pre and post assessment data, and pricing information, being able to determine if what fidelity of use looks like. Was it the teachers? What was it about those teachers, those 8% of educators that really were moving the needle, using the product? Did they get the professional development and others didn't? Was the ones who weren't using it, did they not know about it? Did they not feel like it matched their learning objectives and standards? Or was there some other reason? Now we're able to pull together visibility in sort of a 360-degree fashion to help those districts, understand why that's happening. And it's easy enough for those districts to be empowered to have that conversation with publishers, with the product companies. Frankly, through our platform, it's a little bit easier than what they've been doing in the past, as they sort of manually ran pilots or even just avoided this conversation by, avoiding the sales guy.
When we do our editorial review, we interview educators who are using the products, and we ask them what the strengths are with each product and what the – we don't call them weaknesses. We call them good to knows about the product. What hampered their use of the product more fully or as robustly as the specs suggest the product should be used? Because as Carl suggests, obviously, products should be used in order to be effective, but they should be used correctly as well. So we do annotate how much, how much time should be spent in the product, if the product suggests that, and how best to use the product in our reviews, because it's not just how many people use it, but whether they use it with fidelity determines the results that they get as much. When I'm presenting to publishers, one of the things I've started incorporating in my suggestions is that they do develop robust usage reports, because districts increasingly are focused on the usage of the products and not just whether, but the average time spent in the products. Would be a great metric for publishers to provide to their subscribing districts.
Well, and that's perfect timing. It's time for a regular segment on Ed Schaible Talk, the Donors Choose Project. And each guest from Ed Schaible Talk gets to pick a Donors Choose project, and we donate $50 to those projects. So each of our guests is going to give us a very quick little overview of their project. So, Jackie, can we start with you?
Certainly. I picked Whiteboards to Help Students with Disabilities. It's a local project in the Austin area, which I love that aspect of Donors Choose. You can direct funds to your neighborhood schools and teachers within those schools. And I started my career as a school attorney, in part as a special ed attorney. And this was a project that was very close to meeting its goal. And so I thought this could help them get to the finish line fast. So thank you for that.
You're quite welcome. And Carl, who are you donating to?
Hey, thanks. I'm donating to a great program here in Wake County, great educator. What I love about this mini iPads for math centers is this particular educator makes a very strong case for a combination of hardware and software for a school that needs it, that does not have access to either of the tools, but makes a strong case for how it aligns with her instructional approach and what her particular student groups are looking for. So they are close to the goal. We're very hopeful that they'll meet their But if you search for mini iPads for math centers in Wake County or in North Carolina, you'll see it, and you can help them help some great students here in the Raleigh area.
Excellent. And Christina, what's your choice?
As a former middle school teacher, I have a very special place in my heart for educators working in 6-8. I selected a project to support a teacher working in a high poverty rural area in South Carolina who's focusing on building reading, building literacy through STEM. And what I loved about this project was we know so much of vocabulary acquisition has to come from informational text. And so I love that this teacher was working on really building content knowledge. And we know for students to be successful in college and careers, they need a lot of assistance in literacy and specifically in science and technical subjects. And so I love that the teacher was focused on closing the achievement gap through her work with STEM and building literacy in the content areas.
Excellent. Thank you. And so you can check out Donors Choose at donorschoose.org. So back to the tabletop conversation. As we kind of kick off this second half, I'm just kind of reviewing the questions and the pre-talk conversation we had. And I wanted to hit on one of the things you all thought was important. And let's talk a little bit about trends. What trends are we seeing in usage of instructional resources, what's out there, what's popular, and then what's new and exciting in the field of instructional evaluation or resource or asset evaluation. Let's talk about both sides of that coin.
I would love to jump in here and just share some of the exciting things I'm seeing is that I think districts and states are becoming very supportive and interested in adopting open educational resources. And because we know that no unit or lesson is really an exemplar until a teacher can take it and make it their own to meet the needs of the students in their classroom. And we know that adapting materials for our most vulnerable students is really hard work. And then to be able to take the work that you did on adapting materials and sharing that with other teachers is great. Duval County recently adopted the Engage New York curriculum and adapted it to meet the needs of their district. There's a big shift, I think, in more districts and states promoting and sharing and adopting open educational resources, full curriculum. And again, a lot of the states and districts that are doing that are paying particular attention to alignment to the standards and making sure the materials support all students and have specific criteria in their evaluation tools to evaluate quality and alignment and making sure developers are meeting those criteria.
Christina, you know, we actually review both open educational resources and publisher-produced resources for alignment to state standards and have tools to help people put together the two together, because often the OERs are not 100% aligned. They're supplemental or they're the beginning of a textbook that is designed for educators to build on. And one of the things that we found is in OERs, the content is often good. Where OERs and publisher-produced products differ a lot is in the instructional supports provided mm-hmm. to teachers mm-hmm. and students. Obviously, some people call those bells and whistles. It depends on whether you're talking about a veteran teacher who doesn't need much instructional
right.
support or a beginning teacher who needs a lot of help learning how to teach that particular subject. And as people think about developing new content, whether OER or not, instructional supports are important. And I don't, you know, I'm not talking about the flash. I'm really talking about the content of teaching, either the pedagogical support or the subject matter content support in teaching students.
Yes, and I would I love that I love that you are working to evaluate both published and publisher-developed materials and open educational resources. The state of Louisiana has done really fantastic work in pulling together educator review teams to evaluate both openly licensed curriculum and publisher-developed curriculum, and all of their reviews are publicly posted online. So I think that that's also a trend is and with Ed Reports, you're seeing a lot of reviews of full year-long curriculum being posted online and shared in hopes of creating smarter demand and helping raising the quality and alignment of instructional materials.
I think across the board, the trend that's pretty consistent is a maturity. The market is really maturing around this, right? Going beyond sort of a consumer-based star rating system. We've had, if you look at iTunes, I saw a research report that showed that of the 100,000 education apps in the iTunes store, 85% of them were between 4 and 5 stars. You don't know where that insight comes from. You don't have, obviously, if you're not 4 stars, you're probably not getting looked at. But even if you are, it looks the same. And I think the maturity of the depth of the evaluation, the feedback, whether it's Christina, what you're talking about in Louisiana, the work that you're doing, Jackie, we also see a maturity and a real focus in rapid evaluation of tools. You saw the U.S. Department of Education, Katrina Stevens in the Office of Education Technology, has released some work around this with the What Works Clearinghouse. There are innovation networks around the country, including with folks like Digital Promise. We actually, at Learn Trials, were glad to receive some support from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation to support innovative networks and schools and districts to run rapid evaluations of these curricular and instructional tools, not only for alignment, but for, the types of things that we talked about earlier, fidelity of use, actual student achievement impact, things like that. So I think the big trend that I just consistently see is people are getting much more mature and leveraging the types of data analytics and other resources that are pretty common in other sectors are now being used in education in very meaningful ways.
And while I think rapid reviews are great in using data and to determine usage, and I also think that it's really important when you're doing a review and doing a comprehensive review to provide developers with high-quality, evidence-based, criteria-based feedback to acknowledging, again, that instructional materials are works in progress. And if we want to improve the materials, evidence-based feedback is key in improving materials. And you can also, like I said, creating that feedback loop with the student work and providing them annotated student work samples of how that task just isn't getting what isn't aligned, or how the student work, how their explicit supports that need to be built in. And I just think it's really critical in creating that feedback loop with developers to ensure the materials are high quality and aligned, and we're getting to the student outcomes that we need.
I see one of the trends developing quite rapidly is teacher use of apps. I mean, they've always been doing it. I hear even curriculum directors talk more about teachers using apps. And I think these rapid reviews are well focused on apps, not necessarily as well targeted to full curriculum reviews, full product reviews. But the apps are so, they evolve so quickly that I think that the kind of rubrics for a quick review of those apps are absolutely necessary to this industry. one of the things that I see is there's a maturity in the idea of alignment and the focus of developers on making sure that materials are aligned. I think, however, there is some confusion among publishers about what, and I use the word publishers to include online content developers, about what do educators expect from an alignment or a correlation document. And we spent a year researching what educators meant when they said products weren't aligned. And from what we learned, they want the alignment, the product, to address the nouns, the verbs, and the context of each standard. What I hear publishers again and again say is that we develop correlations as marketing documents. Educators expect those documents to help them target their instruction within the product. And I think that is something that content developers need to be aware of. They're not marketing documents to educators. They're instructional roadmaps. Our alignment report show educators where the materials are aligned to each standards and where the citations that publishers cite are not necessarily fully aligned. I think publishers are doing a better job recognizing the need for alignment, but not necessarily the instructional need for alignment. And that's something I would want to impart on the audience.
You know, there should be explicit evidence in the activities of students and the evidence of in the instruction of targeting those standards. And there should be evidence of the instructional shifts happening in materials. And I agree. And I applaud the publishers that are making the effort to work closely with states and districts to learn about that and what the criteria that they will be evaluated against. You know, the folks at the OER Collaborative had a webinar with anyone that was going to submit materials to be reviewed in their process. They did this webinar to explain sort of the criteria that they were going to be held up against, and see the publishers being so interested and willing to work with the OER Collaborative on that. And I've seen this in several places now where publishers are working closely at the beginning of the RFP process to understand the criteria and the state, district, or partner's commitment to quality and alignment.
We actually get publishers calling us all the time asking us how to do alignment of their material from the beginning of the development of the content. So that's even before the RFP process, Christina, that they are cognizant of the concept. I think there was so much negative publicity about how few products were aligned to the Common Core. We're actually finding that over the last 3 years of doing of thousands of alignments, that products are much more highly aligned. And I think that's a natural progression. Just as districts and teachers are learning the intent and the application of standards, so are publishers. And their products are reflecting a higher degree of alignment to standards.
I agree. The EQIP peer review panel is finding much more high quality and aligned lessons and units that we did before, but we're still seeing a lot of gaps. We actually convened a group of expert educators and practitioners back in January to identify the gaps in instructional materials and sort of focus areas or clusters of standards, and especially specific standards that are important for students to have understanding of and mastery of in order to move forward to the next grade and become and be proficient. And we release that call to action out to developers in February, and then again a high school call to action in September. So we're seeing that there are people are doing hard and good work, but we still have a very long way to go. And I'd welcome you to, you know, Google, achieve, equip, call to action, and review those those focus areas in which we're still seeing gaps in instructional materials?
I think one of the things that we see, that fits in with this sort of feedback loop that you talked about, Christina. So learn trials, I mean, we've got data points, millions of data points across tens of thousands of educators, across thousands of products. There are certainly some trends and some consistencies across that. But going to the rapidity, and this may open up, Bridget, a thing that we'd like to see more of, which is really by making this quicker and easier for school districts. As an example, most of our districts say that they're running pilots or evaluations of products in between 7 and 12% of the time that it used to take them to do that, and getting better data than they had before. And because that's happening, they're actually more willing to engage with the product company to share that experience or share that feedback because it's happening quicker. Because the realities of what a modern school district is, they're pulled in a bunch of different directions sort of constantly. But there's two things that happen. One, it's happening quickly. The second, and what I think we need to continue to build on and see more of, is trust, is really building the trust to have those types of conversations about, whether Jackie's point about, good to knows versus weaknesses versus, where giving a level of detail and feedback that is useful, whether it's about alignment with particular learning objectives or instructional shifts or bugs and glitches or feature mm-hmm. content versus, the student engagement levels. Those different things mean different things to different people. So being able to have that conversation quickly, we think will build more trust. And frankly, as both a former CFO of schools, as well as a three-time ed tech developer, the trust is an important factor to really moving the needle forward when it comes to building between schools and districts and the organizations that are trying to build products to serve them.
Absolutely. One of the things that we're seeing, with online materials, we now actually review the technology requirements for online materials, so which devices, which operating systems and browsers the materials work on and which they don't, as well as other important features that districts are finding increasingly difficult. Single sign-on, et cetera. One of the things that we've noticed is that online content developers don't always make their tech specs easily available. And that would be an easy fix and would certainly enhance the marketability of their products.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Thank you. And another thing that we're seeing is more and more products I think the need for adaptive products is ahead of the development of adaptive products, quite honestly. Within the high-stakes accountability framework that districts are operating in every state and the pressure to differentiate instruction for multiple student groups, teachers are having to rely on instructional materials increasingly to help them differentiate instruction. And I think Christina talked about the adaptions for different student populations, but also the leveled readers, et cetera, to help teachers differentiate the instruction for differently progressing student groups is key. But that poses a unique challenge for reviewing adaptive materials, because no district reviewer is going to sit through 420 hours of instruction to determine whether a product is easy to use, whether it meets the state standards, whether it has bugs and glitches. I do think that as content developers are progressing on their path to develop new products, one thing they could take into account to make their products even more marketable is a bypass of the adaptive features just to allow districts to review those materials more efficiently.
No, that's interesting. Yeah, I think we're really by working inside and across districts, able to collect and get insights, for those folks who have been using those products. Obviously, that's current or past facing, as opposed to future indicative. But I think your recommendation is really interesting. I think that at the end of the day, we talk about this here. Efficacy should matter, right? We think efficacy should matter. We think that if it works for kids or teachers or its intended audience, that should matter. And that as we continue to build trust, as we continue, we're also going to see, I think both sides of the market moving. I think we will continue to see, adaptive, side gaps like Jackie outlined. I think we'll also start to see, rapid response tools or the ability for these districts to really look deeply at this work quickly. And I think that it'll also tie to the pocketbook. I think you're going to start to see folks building this into their RFPs, building things like outcomes and alignment and actual usage into more performance contracts. We're already seeing that in some districts and some state contracts. So, acknowledging there's really a motive for everybody to focus on that efficacy and the outcomes. And those outcomes obviously have to be aligned with what the schools and districts are driving right now.
Right. I agree. I think it's hard to, districts all the time ask me, which product is going to be most effective for our students? And we don't have one indicator of effectiveness. It's really hard to judge prospective effectiveness. But what I would say is, well, first and foremost, the materials must cover the standards you're trying to help students learn. And beyond that, it must be easy to use, it must be engaging, et cetera. One other gap that I'd just like to highlight in the marketplace I'm hearing again and again is engaging content for high school students at various reading levels or various learning levels. Those RTI products or the leveled readers are great in elementary. They're okay in middle school, but they really fall short in high school. And so if content developers are looking for an area, that is one. Our site is a great resource for market intelligence for publishers because it makes it easy to identify where there are products and where there aren't, which have adaptions for each of the different populations, and where there are not many products with adaptions for each of the different populations. So I hope that
so
I've highlighted some of the trends and the gaps.
I think your point about different populations is really critical too. We see this with the districts that we work with. We've integrated public data on every school in the U.S. And so, imagine not being a K-12 company or even a 6-8, math company, but understanding that your product works best, for English language learners in rural districts with more than 50% free and reduced lunch. That's where you're getting strong gains. Being able to analyze and understand down to that level of detail the value of that for how you drive your content and understanding where those gaps are, but also for your sales and marketing, that's, I think, a very different conversation than being, a K-12 publisher or aligning to all the standards. I think getting really focused and be able to answer that level of question quickly will benefit publishers because I think that's the question that schools and districts are asking right now. How do you serve this particular population, right now that I'm trying to address right now? Sorry, Bridget.
That's okay. I'm going to pause this here for a quick reminder that our sponsor for EdTalk Radio is MCH Strategic Data and all the education market data you'll ever need. These are great people who provide amazing resources. So go to mchdata.com for a free quote today. And now's the time, we have about 6 minutes, almost 5 minutes left here, but we're going to do a quick round the table, a regular segment of Gaining the Conference. And each of our guests is going to recommend a conference where you can learn more and better understand best practices and build relationships. So let's start with Christina. What conference do you recommend for our listeners?
the Teaching and Learning Conference, but like I said, I shared in an email with you earlier, I really do feel that the best way to understand best practices, common challenges, and build relationships is to have small focus groups with the people that are doing the hard and good work, the educators and school leaders, and having those conversations absent of selling them on anything, but hearing what their day-to-day is like and getting into that black box a little bit of the classroom to really understand what's going on.
Thanks. And Jackie, what conference would you recommend?
Well, the two different ways to go on this, and Christina referenced that the learning part of conferences is hearing going to conferences where you can hear from practitioners about their challenges and their successes, and those could be administrator conferences or teacher conferences, depending on, you know, where your product is targeted. Another conference that I think is very useful for education entrepreneurs is South by Southwest EDU, because it's a place where I think there are more entrepreneurs actually than educators. And you can hear about what's new in the industry and think about partnershiping concepts, as well as learning a little bit from educators in the different spaces in education.
Great. And Carl, what do you recommend?
Well, I think both Christina and Jackie have mentioned both great conferences and good ways to approach it. I'll just mention coming up in the first quarter, certainly the American Association of School Administrators, AASA, is, I think, in Phoenix this year. And in terms of gaming the conference, I will agree, selling directly. I actually have a blog post coming out in January about the six amazing ways that school administrators are avoiding your phone call. Everything from fake business cards to other approaches that I've had school administrators tell me about, because they are literally getting 20 sales calls a day. So I would say the best way to game that conference is to set up actual conversations with targeted folks, commit some time, do a lot of listening, and go connect with the right folks a little bit outside of, you know, their standard office allows them to share sometimes a little bit more, but make sure you're having meaningful conversations, not just pitching your product constantly.
Great. Thanks, Carl. And I would be remiss if I didn't recommend the SIIA E10 Conference, Software and Information Industries Association Educational Technology Industry Network Spring Networking Conference. It's a great way to network with your peers and colleagues and create great business relationships. Is a terrific B2B opportunity. So we're practically at the top of the hour. That went fast, as great conversations always do. I want to take a quick minute here to thank our guests, Christina Marks, Carl Rectanis, and Jackie Lane. It was wonderful to host you all. And to thank our sponsor, MCH Strategic Data. Don't forget, mchdata.com. And to thank Michael J. for giving me this opportunity, the regular host of EdTable Talk and president of Educational Systemics. I've worked with Michael many, many years, way back before CLEARN, and have to say he's one of the most collaborative people in the industry I've ever worked with. He was great when we were developing our content review criteria. In fact, he had a code name in the office of Secret Squirrel. So next time you see Michael, you can surprise him with that one. So thank you, everyone, for joining the show. Tune in next time for Hi, I'm Your New Teacher, The Life and Times of a New Teacher. Thanks, everyone.
Thank you, Bridget.
Thank you.